the headlines. The Yemeni army now in control of more areas in Marib, fighting its way toward the center of the Flashpoint province held by Saudi-backed militants. A hunger-striking Palestinian in an Israeli jail still refusing to eat as concerns grow over his poor health. And also, protest scuffles and tear gas in Sudan as opponents of a military coup turn out again a day after a deadly security response. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's Saudi Arabia carrying out massive aerial bombardments of neighboring Yemen, targeting multiple locations across several provinces there. The Saudi military hit positions in the provinces of Sana'a, Damar, Sa'ada, and Al-Jaf. So far, we have no word on possible damage or casualties. Riyadh says it launched the aerial campaign after intercepting a drone that attempted to attack the Abha International Airport. That's an airport that Saudi jets often use to launch airstrikes on residential areas in Yemen. Also developing news out of Marib, that's a Flashpoint province, which Yemeni forces have for a while been trying to liberate from militants supported by Saudi Arabia. Yemeni troops who are backed by fighters from popular committees are now in control of several new strategic regions in that province and advancing toward the center. So far, 12 out of 14 cities in Marib have been liberated. We've spoken to our correspondent in Yemen, Abdellatif Al-Washali, to get more about the latest developments inside Yemen. Let's take a listen.
The Saudi regime is continuing to bomb the civilians, to bomb the residential areas. They are only justifying the bombardments by saying that they are attacking military targets. There are no military targets. These attacks will only push the Yemeni army to respond to the attacks, to continue to attack with the drones or the ballistic missiles, to attack the Saudi camps, to attack the Saudi airports that are being used for military purposes, such as Abha. They said, the Saudi media said that the Yemeni army was attempting yesterday to attack Abha airport. The Yemeni army said earlier that this airport is being used for military purposes, is being used for bombing the Yemeni people. So it is the right, the legitimate right for the Yemeni army to respond to these attacks and to bomb whether Abha airport or other military targets inside the kingdom. The Yemeni army is continuing its attack toward Marib to liberate the city. I believe that the Saudi regime has come to realize that they have not achieved anything since the beginning of the war, so they know that the Yemeni army will continue its operations and they will lose at the end of the war.
The United Nations says the summary executions of 10 Yemeni prisoners by Saudi mercenaries was wrong and the perpetrators must be brought to justice.
We condemn the summary execution of 10 individuals belonging to local security forces that took place in Hodeidah Governorate on 13th November. These amount to serious violations of international humanitarian and international human rights law, which must be promptly and thoroughly investigated and perpetrators brought to justice.
Dujarric wants all sides to fully adhere to international humanitarian and human rights laws under all circumstances. Yemen's National Salvation Government has also weighed in on the executions, describing the move as a war crime and a blatant violation of international humanitarian law. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia waged a war against Yemen in 2015 following the ouster of then-President Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions more displaced since then. Concerns are mounting over the deteriorating health condition of a Palestinian prisoner who's been on hunger strike for months. Qaid Fasfous is protesting his arrest under Israel's controversial administrative detention policy. His family has warned that he's facing imminent death.
Qaid Fasfous, a Palestinian prisoner, has been on hunger strike for 126 days to protest his illegal detention by Israeli officials. Qaid's brother has warned of his rapidly deteriorating health condition as he neither takes supplementary tablets nor agrees to undergo medical examinations. The emaciated prisoner has difficulty speaking due to damage done to his nervous system during the strike. Qaid's mother has also described the ordeal her children have gone through in Israel's prison system. Qaid is among the five Palestinian inmates who have refused to eat for weeks in protest at their detention without trial or charge, under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy, something that experts say is tantamount to kidnapping and terrorism.
Israel, as part of this genocidal war on the Palestinian civilian population, kidnaps Palestinians, doesn't charge them, doesn't claim that they committed any crime, just kidnaps them and then tortures them. They call it administrative detention. Well, the real word is terrorism.
Miqdad al-Gawasmi, another prisoner who had abstained from eating for 113 days, ended his hunger strike last Thursday after Israeli officials agreed not to extend his detention without trial beyond February. Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protests at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jails. What they are fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Iran has once again called for the release of Afghanistan's frozen assets, saying the revival of the country's collapsing economy and saving the people's lives should not be politicized.
He called on the international community and in particular donor countries to live up to their responsibilities and extend new and adequate financial resources to Afghanistan neighbors to help Afghan refugees and displaced persons. The timely provision of humanitarian assistance and the release of Afghanistan's frozen assets, which is essential for reviving Afghan's economy and saving people's lives, should in no way be politicized or conditional.
Speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on Afghanistan, Tahta Davanchi warned that the humanitarian situation in the country is highly alarming and should be addressed urgently and properly. He also said an inclusive government is vital to build a secure country. Addressing the same session, Russia's envoy to the UN said regional and extra-regional players all agree that an economic disaster needs to be prevented in Afghanistan. Vasily Nebenzia, however, said that the main burden must be borne by those who occupied the country during the last 20 years.
This would be on the understanding that the main burden of post-conflict economic and financial recovery and on the recovery of development of Afghanistan should be borne by the forces and military contingents who were present in that country over the past 20 years.
The Russian envoy also reiterated his country's commitment to territorial integrity, independence, and sovereignty of Afghanistan. During the session, China's ambassador, Zhang Jun, also highlighted the necessity of preventing the rise of terrorism in Afghanistan. He urged the international community to support efforts made by Afghanistan's neighbors to help stabilize the country. Iran's special envoy to Afghanistan has sat for separate talks with the Taliban officials on ways to expand mutual ties between the two neighboring countries in various areas. Ahmatullah Bawan has more in this report.
On the last day of his stay in the Afghan capital, Kabul, Iran's special envoy to Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qumi, held separate meetings with a number of the Taliban officials on mutual ties. Acting ministers of agriculture, economy, refugees affairs, information and culture, commerce and industry, and tribal and borders affairs were among the officials who held talks with the Iranian envoy. During the talks, both sides announced their readiness for expansion of ties in different areas and discussed ways for further cooperation.
I have always said that Afghanistan is a strong country. It has a great history and culture and enjoys rich national resources. Enemies have never let the country grow its capacities, but we are here to help you reach that goal. Iran uses all its means to serve the Afghan people. My demand is that let's put the bureaucracy away and get united. We need to trust each other and miss no opportunity for further cooperation.
Qumi arrived in the Afghan capital, Kabul, on Monday at the head of a delegation for talks with the new government in the neighboring Afghanistan.
We held good talks with the Afghan sides on the refugee affairs and border security. We agreed on a number of issues which are of importance for both sides. We also addressed the border security and underlined the urgency to fight human trafficking. In all areas, we agreed to expand our cooperation.
We exchanged views with the Iranian delegation and talked about our main priorities. Iranian representatives agreed to help us in cultural affairs, including higher education and the movie industry. We need to show the cruelty of Afghanistan's enemies in movies.
Iran has called for formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan representing all Afghans. It has also called for an end to violence in the country. Iran says it attaches significant importance to the security and welfare of Afghanistan adding a stable Afghanistan serves not only the interests of the region, but that of the whole world. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Welcome back. The situation remains volatile in Sudan, with anti-coup protesters and police facing off again in Khartoum after a day of bloody scuffles. Just hours ago, security forces fired tear gas to push back protesters from barricades. Large numbers of police are now deployed in the north of the capital, where crowds kept up their protests throughout the night. The deadliest crackdown since the military took over happened on Wednesday. At least 15 protesters were killed. The military seized power late last month and arrested dozens of government officials, including the prime minister. Scores of protesters have been killed and hundreds of others injured since then. We've spoken to political commentator Abiy Elmiazi Kiwe about the recent flare-up of violence in Sudan. He's convinced that the brutality launched by the army against protesters will not resolve the crisis there.
Well, what is going on is that the people are continuing to go into the streets, protest against the military coup that occurred on October the 25th. This is the second day of action within less than a week, and the head of the military junta, Abd al-Fattah al-Burhan, has appointed a new sovereign council, which does not have the support of the political forces that were involved in the initial coalition government that was formed over 2 years ago. He has recruited some of the previously armed opposition groups, for example, Malik Agar and others, and they have announced today that they're going to release political prisoners within 48 hours. We'll have to see if that's going to be the case. And he also announced, Mr. Agar, that there needed to be negotiations to reach a political settlement. However, with the brutality that's being launched against the protesters, what we saw on Saturday, what we also saw today, does not bode well for any genuine and positive negotiations to resolve the dispute.
Taiwan commissions the first squadron of its F-16s that have been upgraded with U.S. help in a new military cooperation that will likely draw an angry response from China. Taiwan's president says the project shows that her government and Washington are committed to their partnership, taking the stage together with a top American diplomat at an airbase. Tsai Ing-wen said more like-minded countries would stand on the same front as Taiwan and the U.S. Taipei has a deal worth $4 billion with Washington for upgrading its F-16 fleet. There are fears that Chinese and U.S. exercises in the region could spark off a military conflict. Beijing views Taiwan as part of its territory and is angered at U.S. military support for the island. President Xi of China reminded U.S. President Biden, as they met online days ago, that Taiwan is a red line for Beijing. We've asked author and columnist Daner Tangen to give us his analysis of the latest military cooperation between the U.S. and Taiwan. Listen to him explaining why this is an opportunity for Washington to beef up its foreign arms sales.
It's an opportunity for the military-industrial complex of the U.S. to sell arms to a country that needs to concentrate on its economy, not on making war. Well, Beijing has already sanctioned Raytheon, which is the maker of the F-16. I would imagine that there will be more, there will be more action against those U.S. companies that are involved. But remember, coming so close on the heels of the Biden-Xi summit, it does not portend well. I mean, the U.S. continues to treat Taiwan as a political card, as an asset that they could literally dispose of if necessary, whereas China sees Taiwan as a red line. So having the kind of managed competition talk from Biden against the reality of what they're doing just a few days later, it speaks of the hypocrisy, just like after the COP26 climate change summit 2 days later. The Interior Department held the largest sale of any kind of oil rights in the Gulf of Mexico has ever been had before.
More drama unfolding at the border between Poland and Belarus, with Polish forces detaining around 100 migrants overnight. Warsaw accuses the Belarusian forces of cutting the fence along the border to let the migrants pass. So far, no reaction from Minsk to that accusation, but it has rejected similar allegations in the past. Thousands of men, women, and children, mainly from the Middle East and Asia, are camped at the border for a chance to cross into the European Union. The situation remains grim there, with large crowds of desperate people struggling to survive in the freezing cold without food, water, and medicine. The European Commission says COVID-19 cases are on the rise in almost all of the EU's 27 member states. High hospital admission numbers are putting health systems under pressure. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Saint-Pierre has always been one of the busiest hospitals in Brussels, but now it is busier than ever. In the 24 hours up to Wednesday, more than 12,000 new cases of coronavirus were recorded in Belgium and 41 deaths. Even at the doors of Saint-Pierre, it's easy to find people who are vaccine hesitant.
I feel concerned for my part, but I know people from my age feel concerned but aren't really good with the idea of getting vaccinated.
I don't need the vaccine because it's 2 years there is the coronavirus, but I'm good. I'm very good. I'm not sick. And my family is not sick.
COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging across the EU. In Italy, workers cannot physically attend to their jobs without a COVID pass. Experts suggest the country is doing better than neighbours because more children there have received the jab. In Austria, the unvaccinated have effectively been put into lockdown. Most venues in the Netherlands must close by 8 p.m. Hospitals in Ireland, Czech Republic, Bulgaria and Romania are struggling to cope.
So the message remains clear. Get vaccinated. Maintain masks and social distance. Vaccination is necessary in our fight against this virus.
A fifth wave of the virus is hitting France, Germany and Belgium. Health experts say there is still a lot about the crisis that is not understood. For example, it is not known why the vaccines do not work on 10% of people who take them. It is not clearly known for how long the vaccines remain effective. What is known, however, is that people who are vaccinated are far less likely to end up in hospital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Since 2019, more than 320 toxic substances have been detected in U.S. drinking water systems. According to a new analysis by the Environmental Working Group, EWG, a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Honija Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Hundreds of Toxic Chemicals Are Coursing Through U.S. Tap Water, new report says. Stay tuned for more. Since 2019, more than 320 toxic substances have been detected in U.S. drinking water systems. According to a new analysis by the Environmental Working Group, EWG, a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization, those harmful chemicals are linked to cancer, adverse birth and reproduction outcomes, impaired brain development, and a revolving door of other deleterious health impacts. The findings, part of the 2021 update of EWG's National Tap Water Database, underpin the call for more rigorous federal drinking water standards and the urgency to improve water infrastructure. EWG researchers collected and reviewed results from water contaminant tests conducted by water utilities and regulators from all 50 states and the District of Columbia. After combing through the data after almost 50,000 water systems serving tens of millions of American households, the researchers found sweeping drinking water contamination from numerous pollutants such as arsenic, lead, pear, and polyfluoroalkyl substances, that is PFAS, radioactive materials, and pesticides. The database offers a panoramic view of what drinking water quality looks like when the federal office meant to protect U.S. water is in an advanced stage of regulatory capture, said EWG President Ken Cook in a statement referring to the influence of polluting industries and water utilities on drinking water safety standards. Compared to the previous study's 2019 update to the database, which identified 268 chemicals in America's water utilities, the new database added 56 new chemicals. These substances are new PFAS or emerging pollutants such as pesticides and radioactive material that are currently monitored by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, under the agency's Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. However, these substances have yet to receive any legal limits, thwarting the water system's impetus to tackle the contamination, adding to EWG. Currently, the EPA regulates more than 90 contaminants in drinking water, a fraction of the agency's inventory of more than 85,000 chemicals that fall under the Toxic Substances Control Act. The EPA's Office of Water has not added any new substances to its regulated list since 2006. Even for substances that are regulated by the EPA, their legal limits were set based on outdated science. Alama Ike, an environmental health scientist at WG who helped construct the tap water database, told EHN, while the EPA determines contaminants regulatory standards based on their individual harms, it fails to consider the additive effect of a chemical mixture. He said, we are not being exposed to just one contaminant when we are drinking water. We are being exposed to multiple contaminants. The EPA's water regulations assure that public water systems are monitoring and taking actions to achieve meaningful reductions to human health risks from contaminants in accordance with the Safe Drinking Water Act, an EPA spokesperson told EHN. The agency also has evaluated a number of unregulated drinking water contaminants under the Safe Drinking Water Act and is taking actions to update its regulations, said the spokesperson. Consumers can enter their zip code into the tap water database and see a report of toxic contaminants in the area's drinking water as well as safety assessments put together by EWG scientists. In many areas, various dangerous contaminants have been uncovered in water samples, although they were still in compliance with federal health-based drinking water standards. Even if your water is below the legal limit, that doesn't necessarily mean it is safe from contaminants. Carsten Press, an environmental professor who studies drinking water contamination at Johns Hopkins University but was not involved in EWE's database, told EHN that it's great to provide individuals with more transparency about what might be in their water, because the data collected in this database are obtained from water utilities. Press cautioned that contaminants listed may not present the water quality in individual households. For instance, while the report may show the absence of lead in some utilities, certain individual households may still have lead coming out of the tap due to pollution from the water pipes. Press said that the current federal regulations aren't really directed towards protecting the consumers of drinking water, and that there has been a gap between the regulations and scientific progress. Press said there is definitely a lot of room for improvement.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Lee. The use of sanctions as blind instruments to pressure nations. That is one accusation that has been leveled against the UN, an international body that was created to resolve world crises, not to be a tool by mostly Western veto-wielding members to be used against other nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the shortfalls of the UN Security Council, the reforms that many are asking for the Council to go through, particularly why it has been used as a tool for political gains.
The Security Council is one of the six primary organs of the United Nations, created after the Second World War. The Council has wide-ranging powers, including the approval of changes to UN charters, enacting international sanctions, and even authorizing military action. The UNSC is arguably the most powerful UN organ because it is the only one with the ability to pass binding resolutions. Hence, it would not be an exaggeration to say its decisions could have global impact. However, despite its immense importance, the Council is anything but inclusive. Although the UN General Assembly has more than 190 members, only 15 are in the Security Council. Of those, 10 gain their seats on a rotating basis, while only five countries, namely the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, are permanent members with veto powers. This puts enormous power in the hands of only a few governments, which have time and again shown they are not afraid of using it. In the past, the Council has imposed sanctions on countries like Libya, North Korea, and Yemen. Iran, also a victim of UNSC sanctions, has censured the Council's use of such restrictions under unsubstantiated pretexts. Tehran's UN ambassador on Tuesday described sanctions as blunt and blind instruments that raise fundamental ethical questions. He said the sanctions should be reserved as a last resort, but right now they are being used as a tool of collective punishment.
In the past, certain Security Council sanctions have served only to collectively punish an entire nation, without any actual positive impact on the maintenance of international peace and security.
Furthermore, the Iranian ambassador criticized the UNSC's makeup. He declared that the council must be reformed to ensure equitable rather than geographical representation. He also slammed the disproportionate presence and power of Western nations in the influential organ.
Currently, the West has a strong presence and influence in the council. Three of its members have veto power, while the main regions are fully represented in terms of both the number as well as privileges, including veto power. This means inequality among the regions.
The stated goal of the Security Council is to maintain international peace and security, but on numerous occasions it has in fact acted as an obstacle in the way of justice. For instance, the veto-wielding United States has blocked the passage of over 50 resolutions critical of Israel's policies since 1972, and U.S.-backed Israel, too, has defied dozens of resolutions on its crimes against Palestinians with impunity. The Security Council's far-reaching jurisdiction makes its importance hard to overstate. That significance is perhaps exactly what makes the Council's overhaul more needed in the current circumstances.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Alfred de Zayas, who's a former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. Also joining us is Macharia Munen, a UN expert on decolonization, who joins us on the phone from Nairobi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me first start with you, Alfred Zayas, if I may. And I would like to ask whether you agree with this stance on the UN, that it is a truly representative, effective, transparent, accountable, and above all, rules-based body.
I could, in my 14 reports to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly, I frequently identified the obstacles exactly to being such an effective rules-based organization. My former boss, Secretary General Kofi Annan, was one of the first to recognize the problems and to propose very concrete reforms to the United Nations in general and in particular to the Security Council. In my 2013 report to the General Assembly, I also laid out a plan of action how to reform the system, how to reform the Security Council, and I reflect that, by the way, in my new publication, Building a Just World Order, which also includes 25 principles of international order. Of course, we can and must reform the United Nations. But obviously, those five powers that possess not only permanent membership but also the veto power are not likely to give up their privileges that easy. Article 108 of the UN Charter allows for amending the Charter. It has been used before. The size of the council, for instance, has been increased. Kofi Annan proposed that it be increased from 15 to 25, and obviously that means that major countries like India and Brazil and Japan also have a claim to membership in the Security Council. Whether they would ever get the veto power is something else. Initially, I used to be very critical of the veto power. On the other hand, I remember a debate I had in the General Assembly, and the Russian ambassador at the time took me to task because I said, look, if we didn't have the veto power, NATO countries would go ahead and bombard the rest of the world and call it legal because it would be approved by the Security Council. And then he said, look, we made a mistake back in 2011 when supposedly humanitarian assistance was going to be given to Libya. And instead of humanitarian assistance, what NATO did was to bomb the hell out of it. That was Resolution 1973, which went through not with the approval of Russia and China, but with their abstention. So in the future, clearly, the Soviet Union, or rather Russia and China, have blocked supposedly humanitarian intervention resolutions tabled, for instance, against Syria. And that is understandable. So if you're going to do away with the veto power, make sure that that doesn't open the floodgates for indiscriminate attacks under Chapter 7. It is Chapter 6 of the UN Charter that should be used, which is the Charter on Pacific Settlement.
Okay. All right, let's bring in Macharia Munin into this. Macharia Munin, our guest there talked about one example, and that was the Libya case, and also he talked about the veto power. In your assessments or in your recollection, what perhaps has led to calls for reforms for the UN? What examples can you give us, or reasons that you think the UN needs to be reformed? And where did it go wrong that this call was made? Because it's been in the works for quite some time, the call for reform for the UNSA.
That different. When the UN Security Council was formed back in 1945, the logic of it was that the Security Council was there to protect the interests of the then big powers. That's why they gave themselves veto, that they were the ones to determine what is safe for the world, and in case any of their interests were to be infringed by global democracy, then they gave themselves the power to reject global democracy. So the environment of the 1945 after World War II is now very different. We have more countries, we have more assertive interests coming into field, and we have seen over time that the big powers of the day, at that time, which appeared to be in agreement, are no longer working together. They do not look after the interest of the world. Instead, they look after their perceived interest. And sometimes they make decisions that would otherwise not be acceptable just because they are big. The example given about the invasion of Libya through the UN Security Council's supposed resolution is an example of that. Of course, there have been issues of vetoes when it comes to what Israel does or does not do. And in the days of the Cold War, there appeared to have been competitions between the United States and the Soviet Union as to who can veto more than the other the UN resolutions. So now, with the increasing talk of global democracy, and it is an increasing talk of global democracy, then the idea that one country can veto the world interest becomes obnoxious. We also have a few more countries that feel that they are strong enough to be in the big boys club. So you have Brazil, you have India, you have Japan, you have Germany, which are big economic powers, but they are not acceptable because they were supposedly not there in 1945, or they were on the wrong side of the big powers of the day. Today, some of them are seen to be good boys, good countries, yet they are not acceptable into the Security Council as permanent members. The challenge that comes is convincing the five permanent members that they should expand their numbers and dilute their own power is a very challenging thing.
Sure. Well, that's one of the things that Alfred Desaias, I'm curious as to how it can be solved in terms of the fair distribution of a say for countries that do not have representation, in a matter of speaking, or even continents. I mean, you're looking at the five countries that have the veto power. Is this the major, you think, problem that the UN has? Because when you have the Middle East, or we call West Asia, or Africa not having that representation, then what can be done? Adding countries to the list, is that a solution? This is for Alfred Desaias. Alfred Desaias, this question is for you. Go ahead.
Well, I fully agree with what my colleague, Professor Macharia Munene, just said. Beyond that, obviously, just a numerical increase of the Security Council will make it somewhat more equitable, somewhat more representative of the world. But what you want also is what Ambassador Majid Sankta Ramanchi said, to address the ethical issues that are involved. There, about a third of the population of the world is suffering under illegal unilateral coercive measures, which have been condemned by the General Assembly and have been condemned by the Human Rights Council repeatedly. What the international community has to do, and that is the responsibility of the General Assembly, is to elevate the issue to the highest judicial instance of the United Nations, being the International Court of Justice. And it is quite clear to me that sanctions kill. Not only do sanctions kill, but they kill hundreds of thousands of people. Because that is that, it should be declared not only illegal, because it is of course illegal, but a crime against humanity. And then that should be referred on to the International Criminal Court to prosecute those countries that have imposed sanctions on other countries which suffer, they're crippled, for instance, in the battle against COVID-19, and their economies are asphyxiated. So that has to be addressed, and these are ethical issues. These are issues of human rights, of the right to life, of the right to food, of the right to water, etc. So back to the reform proposals, yes, let's increase the membership from 15 to 25, but there are many other mechanisms that must be put in place. Uh-huh. There is, by the way, a working group of the General Assembly that is looking and has been looking for the last 15 years, looking at reform. But of course, that gets systematically blocked by those who are not interested in reform.
Sure.
But the possibility is there, Article 108 of the UN Charter, which provides for amendment.
Macharia Munene, let's look at a case in point here when it comes to sanctions. And that would be no better place to start with than the Islamic Republic of Iran. When you take a look at what has been leveled against Iran in terms of sanctions, the story obviously is very long. But my question to you is, do you think that using Iran as an example, that you have three of the five countries that have the veto power to have leveled sanctions against Iran for their own political gains? That is one of the critiques that has been leveled against the UN when it comes to Iran, specifically those three countries, in order to achieve whatever objectives they have by their use of sanctions, which Iran deems illegal.
The sanctions, in many instances, are placed on technicalities, many of them illegal. We do have, I think, in the case of Iran at present, there are some that were largely imposed by the last administration, the U.S. administration, which negated its own treaty on the and what had been agreed. And the interesting thing is that the new administration, U.S. administration, continues to stick to those sanctions and not very willing to review the whole thing. But sanctions are politically driven moves by powerful countries that use the United Nations as an instrument of their own foreign policy. So in this case, the three powers with the veto capacity are the United Nations, who are also negotiating, involved in the Iran treaty on nuclear activities. It is a political tool, and this should be understood that way. As to whether or not there can be reforms, we can demand reforms. In fact, it is an attitude thing, and it is for the General Assembly collectively to come together and shame the ones who are standing on the way of reform, and to point out that the sanctions which are targeted for the wrong reasons are actually tantamount to criminality in the global thinking. But that mind frame of the big powers, that they have to protect themselves irrespective of what, is what needs to be, it's unethical, but it's a moral issue, and they need to be ashamed in order to see sense that they should accommodate other people.
Okay, Alfred Isaias, I'm going to ask you whether you can guess what entity we're talking about here. And this question that I have for you is that since the inception of the Council, this would be the UN HRC, okay? Since its inception in the year 2006, it has issued 142 condemnations against UN member states. Out of the 142, 95 was leveled against, and I'm wondering if you know who that would be.
Well, the United Nations Human Rights Council does have a focus on Israel, and it does have a permanent item on its agenda on Israel, so it's no surprise that there are so many resolutions adopted against Israel. On the other hand, you have to consider that since 1967, there is a Security Council resolution 242 that condemned the occupation of Palestine territories by Israel, and that in 2004, the International Court of Justice issued a very clear, long advisory opinion on the illegality of Israeli actions in Palestine territories, in particular the building of the wall, and that Israel has flouted countless resolutions of the General Assembly and of the Human Rights Council. So, hello. I mean, you cannot be part of the international community and continue flouting the violations, or rather the resolutions that have been adopted telling you to correct the situation. That's why the General Assembly, surely the Security Council will not adopt resolutions against Israel, because they will be vetoed either by the United States, the United Kingdom, or France. On the other hand, the General Assembly can here take the lead and in particular elevate a number of legal issues under Article 96 of the UN Charter. The General Assembly can ask the International Court of Justice to rule on some of these issues. And I'm saying not only Israel, also on the issue of collective punishment.
Sure. But my point here was when you have the incident that happened at the end of October, and let me make sure that I get this right, where you have the at the UNGA, you have the
Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, at the podium there, tear up that report. It just shows that Israel doesn't want to follow international laws, which it keeps breaking, and resolutions are leveled against it. That was the point that I was trying to get at. Unfortunately, we just are fresh out of time. I do have to end this spotlight, but thank you, Alfred Desaias, former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. And the name of your book is A Just World Order, which is the book by Desaias. Also, Macharia Munen, thank you, UN expert on decolonization from Nairobi. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikovi Tafwai, it's goodbye until next time.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz. Every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Dear listeners, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Back to Reality. We are glad to have you all on the show. Over here, we discuss about different but interesting topics which we can relate to our daily life. And I'm your host, Hassanain, and today we have got two special guests with us. Salaamu alaikum, brother Sayyid Mohsen.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Welcome to the show. And can you please tell our audience where you're from and what's your field of study?
I'm from Pakistan. I'm currently pursuing my PhD in Islamic economics from the Hawza Al-Miqom.
MashaAllah. And we also have brother Sayyid Abdullah with us. Salaamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you here, and can you please tell our audience where you're from and what's your field of study?
I am from Iraq, currently residing in Australia. My field of study is Quran and Hadith.
MashaAllah. Dear listeners, so without any further delay, let's start with our main discussion. And the topic for today is it necessary to learn about different religions? So brothers, in today's world, we are having a lot of different religions, like different people following different religions. And the interesting part is all of them claim to be the righteous one. In this scenario, do you have to learn about different religions to know about our own religion and to know that if our religion is the right one?
When we talk about the religion, it is necessary to first learn about your own religion. Because if you are not aware of your own religion, then it is very easy for someone else to take you away or to attract you towards his own religion.
Own religion, do you mean the religion
whichever religion, yes. Whichever religion they follow, they're, obviously he was grown up in a society. Yeah. Maybe he's a Christian, he's a Muslim, he's a Hindu. So the basic, like logically, when we talk about this issue, it is necessary to know about your own religion first, especially if you're a Muslim, and try to learn, read some theological books, the proofs why you are a Muslim, why there is only one God, and there is no other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, why we are monotheist. So first of all, we need to learn about our own religion. Later, I don't say like it is necessary to learn about different religions, but later if you have any dialogues, it is better to refer to someone who knows about it. Mm-hmm. You know, because we haven't learned many things. Still, we can see in the Muslim community, people even don't know what does Quran says, where the Quran is the book of guidance.
Yeah.
People haven't even read the translation, a simple translation of the whole Holy Quran. So when they do not know about their own religion, it's an obligation on them, basically. That's what I would like to say, mm-hmm. that to learn about your religion first, what are the reasons that you're Muslim, why you follow such a religion, what are the proofs, so that tomorrow if someone basically asks you a question or maybe brings an argument, you should be able to answer that. And generally the process of learning other religions starts from where we get involved into different dialogues practically. Yeah. Or maybe we are searching about something, we have a doubt in our minds about a topic, maybe a subject, and then we go further and read the other religions or maybe a specific part of that religion.
Let's stop here. Inshallah, we continue after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back to your listeners, and we're discussing about if it's necessary to learn about different religions.
With us, we have what we call Usuluddin and Furu'uddin, right?
Yeah.
Branches and the roots of religion. When it comes to Usuluddin, the branches and the pillars of faith that we have, we say there is no taqlid in that. There is no imitation, there is no following.
Yeah.
So you need to find out Allah for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You need to understand who Allah is, who the Prophet is, Imams, and so on and so forth. So there's a kind of emphasis in Islam that you need to study for yourself when it comes to the matters of belief, first and foremost.
Yeah.
And when you want to know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, obviously you have to ask yourself,
mm-hmm.
am I the right one?
Yeah.
Am I on the right track? Is Islam the right religion to begin with?
Yeah.
So if you're blessed to be in a Muslim family,
mm-hmm.
well, obviously you got a head start.
Yeah.
But now you have to ask yourself, what makes my God the correct, right God and not the other gods?
Mm-hmm.
Why not Jesus Christ? Why not Buddha? Why not, you know, whatever they want to call them?
Yeah.
So why not them? So at least you do have a bit of requirements
mm-hmm.
to do a bit of search and to try to study as well. We're not saying, well, study them for the sake of trying to see if they are true, but at least get to know what they're talking about. And then you make that comparison with yourself and find the right one. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, one thing he does not take lightly, and that's a blind following.
Yeah.
Every time in the Quran when he says, why did you do this? قَالُوا وَجَدْنَا أَبَاءُنَا. We found our parents, and then we're just going to follow. So me as a Muslim, if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts me to the stand and says to me, why you're a Muslim? I have to be able to give him an answer.
Yeah.
If he says to me, why you're a Shia? I have to be able to give him an answer. If he says to me, why did you believe in me?